So there I was, walking through the Genghis Khan exhibit at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California, reading the various displays on the Great Khan and the Mongols, when I came upon what launched an investigation. It was a display that spoke of a Mongolian Marco Polo named Rabban Sangha. As I read, curiosity quickly turned to fascination. I'd never heard of this man or his amazing career, and my question was, why not? You see, the story of Marco Polo is a standard part of the teaching of world history. His life and career are central to the prompts of what's known as the Age of Discovery. Entire miniseries have been made of his amazing tale. But unknown to most Westerners is the story of an equally fascinating character of the same period of time, a Mongol Christian priest who ended up acting as an ambassador of the Mongols to the Pope and the kings of both France and England. Before that, Rabban Sangha was instrumental in establishing the new patriarch of the Venerable Church of the East. This man lived a truly epic life containing three separate sagas. I'm going to tell his story in this episode, and I hope that you find it as interesting as I do. This series on church history on the Enduring Word YouTube channel, well, it's a video version of an ongoing audio podcast that I did some years ago. Now, that audio podcast went to a total of 150 episodes and ended the tale of church history in the late 19th century. After that, because of the interest of subscribers, I launched what I called Season 2, and that was, well, a deep dive into the subjects we'd really only been able to briefly cover in Season 1. And one of the series of podcasts that I did in Season 2 was on Rabban Sangha. I had picked up a book on him in the gift shop at the Reagan Library. I read it and then did some additional research online and realized that his story ought to be told. I did so over a total of 12 episodes on that audio podcast. Then in this video version of Church History on the Enduring Word YouTube channel, I knew I needed to share Sangha's tale and produced 6 episodes by condensing material from the original 12. But then after all of that, it occurred to me that while maybe 10% of our viewers might find the story of Rabban Sangha as interesting as I, the other 90% would probably wonder why I was going to such detail and drawing out his story. And so I condensed the 6 episodes into a single episode, though it kills me to do it. The things I do for you, the viewer. Now, for that 10% who wish for more on Rabban Sangha, you can find it on the original audio podcast. You can do a search for it on the History of the Christian Church in your podcast app, or just go to the website sanctorum.us. Okay, here we go in the epic saga of Rabban Sangha. The Angud tribe lived just north of China's Great Wall. They'd been a fertile field of Christian missions and were one of the first groups to throw in with Genghis Khan as he united the tribes of Central Asia. In the early 13th century, an Angud noble named Shaban and his wife lived in the city of Zhongdu, which is the later future city of Beijing. They longed for a child but were unable to conceive. Their prayers and fasting were answered, and a son was born to them, whom they named Bar Sangha, meaning son of the fast. It was the year 1220. Now, the piety of the parents was passed on to the son, who showed an extraordinary interest in spiritual things from a young age. He was given a religious education, learning 3 languages, the Turkic of his native people, Chinese, which of course was the official tongue of the realm, and Syriac, which was the liturgical language of the Nestorian Church of the East that he was a part of. Bar Sangha proved so adept at his studies that he was entrusted with special duties at his hometown church. While his parents were proud of their son's piety, they were disappointed when at the age of 20, he informed them that he wanted to be a monk. Since monks were required to be celibate, and he was their only child, they worried that the family estate and name would be lost, which was considered a great tragedy in that culture. They attempted to maneuver Sangha into marriage, but over time they came around to his way of seeing things and resigned themselves to his choice. At the age of 25, Bar Sangha was ordained a priest, but remained a monk and headed off to a secluded place in the Fang Mountains. The isolation that he yearned for was often interrupted by people who made a pilgrimage to his humble home, seeking a glimpse, maybe a word, from the holy man whose fame was spreading. Though he preferred a life of quiet contemplation, he met with everyone who sought him out. And that would have been Sama's entire life, and one that we'd never have heard of, if it were not for one of those pilgrims, a 15-year-old named Marcos. Marcos didn't just want to spend a couple days with Barsama, he wanted a mentor, someone who would teach him everything that he had to share. Barsama tried to dissuade Marcos, just as his parents had tried to dissuade him when he was younger. But it didn't take long before Barsama recognized in Marcos the same zeal and dedication that had burned in his own soul. 3 years later, Marcos had proven himself devotionally sincere, academically capable, and of equal spiritual mettle with his master. He was ordained as a monk in the Nestorian Church. Now, after a decade together in their mountain retreat, Marcos's intellectual curiosity prompted a spiritual itch that saw the two men descend from their mountain retreat to embark on a journey of literally epic consequence. Marcos wanted to visit the scenes and sites where the biblical story had played out, as well as the headquarters of the Nestorian Church, which was at that time in Persia. Now, in his studies, Marcos read of Christians of other sects and wanted to meet them. Nothing less than a journey to the far reaches of the West could scratch that itch. Marcos shared his dream with his mentor, who is now really more of a friend than a master. The young man's longing to discover new lands and people inspired a kindred desire in Barsama. It was 1275 when they made plans to set out, the same year that Marco Polo arrived in China. They headed to Zhongdu to hire guides and gather provisions. And at first, church leaders there scoffed at the undertaking. The venture was deemed both physically impossible and spiritually wasteful. Sama and Marcos were deft at waving aside the objections. Their only ambition was to faithfully follow the path that they were convinced that God had set them on. Their focus won over the opposition. They went from resistance to hearty support for the venture of faith of the two monks. Now, they estimated that just the first part of the journey to Persia would take about 6 months and require a caravan of a decent size. Once their supporters got on board, they generously supplied the needed funds. When the Mongol court saw the seriousness with which Marcos and Sama proceeded, they decided to add their support. This was during the reign of the famous Kublai Khan. A pragmatic ruler, Kublai, wanted to cover all of his religious bases and hoped to gain the Christian god's favor by supporting the monks' trip. So he gave them financial support and provided them with the all-important letters patents that allowed them to pass unmolested through Asia. Now, these letter patents were called paizu in Chinese, and quite frankly, they were the forerunner of our modern passports. They not only served as evidence of official sanction from Kublai's court, they were certain to gain a warm welcome among his allies. Even the Khan's enemies would be careful to treat his emissaries with respect, because mistreating a Mongol envoy was a sure way to a lot of pain. With both church and state backing, Barsama and Marcos set off on their adventure. Their guides took them on the first leg of the journey and then were replaced with new guides who were familiar with the territory that they entered next. Now, all along their route through China, local officials tried to persuade Sama and Marcos to stay, hoping to make some points off the growing fame of the two monks. Marcos and Sama became adept at tactfully declining these attempts to stall their journey. Some of these guys even tried to force them to stay. That was when the monks pulled out their letters patent from the Great Khan. They were inevitably ushered quickly with fresh supplies to the city gate. Now, Barsama and Marcos followed the Chinese postal route west until it ended at the eastern border of Central Asia, and that's when things became dicey for the travelers. They skirted the southern edge of the dreaded Taklamakan Desert. Barsama's account includes the terse comment that this was a toilsome and fatiguing part of their journey. Knowing how austere and arduous their prior lives had been, we might use terms like brutal and soul-crushingly exhausting. They finally arrived in the booming trade center of Koh Tan, which was a meeting place of the Far East and the Middle East. After a brief time of recovering from the trip across the desert, they resumed their journey. Now, the next leg of their journey was another endurance challenge. They headed into northeastern Persia, skirting present-day Afghanistan. Crossing the rugged Hindu Kush mountains and barren deserts, they lost a good part of their baggage to the many warlords who controlled that area. They finally arrived in the first of their destinations, Persia, home and headquarters of their faith, the Nestorian Church of the East. It was the year 1280, and Islam was the predominant religion, but the Mongols, who were in charge, had a policy of religious tolerance. Now, Sama and Marcos headed to Baghdad, which was the headquarters of the Nestorian Church and home of their Catholicos, the Church of the East's leader. It was a man named Bardana. And let's just say this was a seriously bad guy. He was so bad, the regional Mongol ruler, whose name was Abaka, had refused to recognize Bardana as the Catholicos for 15 years. Of course, when Barsama and Marcos arrived in Baghdad, they had no knowledge of all of this. They came with the assumption that the head of their church must be a godly man. It didn't take long for them to realize that Bardana was a snake. When they pressed him to let them continue on their journey to Jerusalem, he instead decided to weave them into his plans. Bardana promised that he'd let them go with his blessing if they would ask the Mongol ruler Abaka to finally recognize him as the Catholicos. Now, Abaka held Sama and Marcos in great esteem for two reasons. Number one, it was obvious that they were sincere men of God and of outstanding character. And number two, they had the official endorsement of Abaka's boss, the great Kublai Khan. So when they asked him to endorse Bardana as the Nestorian Catholicos, he finally relented. He then gave his officials strict orders to assist Barsam and Marcos on the last leg of their journey to Jerusalem. They made it to the Black Sea when they learned that the way to Jerusalem was closed due to war. So back to Persia they went. Bardana then sought to extend his influence by tying the monks closer to himself. He promoted both of them to the position of Rabban, roughly equivalent to a rabbi, or let's say an abbot of a monastery. But conveyed in the title of Rabban is the sense of elite scholarship and a gravitas of person that's worthy of the greatest respect. Bardana then named Marcos the metropolitan, the bishop of the entire East Asia. Sama was made the Nestorian visitor general in China. You can think papal ambassador, and you get the sense of the gravity of that appointment. Now, as was the custom, Marcos was given a new name from the Syriac language as he was elevated to the position of metropolitan, a bishop. And that new name was Mar Yabalaha, a name which means God-given. Bardana then ordered the two newly minted Rabbans to return to China, where he hoped to exert his influence through them. So much for their plans to visit Jerusalem and points even further west. Before they could set out, though, war broke out and closed the route home to the east. Then, in February of 1281, Bardana unexpectedly died. Church leaders met in Baghdad to select a new leader. The discussions didn't take long. They asked Marcos, the now named Mar Yabalaha, to become the new Catholicos. He resisted at first, but was persuaded by his friend Rabban Sama to accept. Abaka was quick to ratify Mar Yabalaha's election. So at the age of just 36, Marcos of China, a once humble teenager who aspired to little more than the life of a monk in the Fang Mountains of his homeland, had risen to become the leader of his entire denomination. And not just a denomination as we think of it, but one of the three major branches of the Christian church, the Nestorian Church of the East. Now that's quite a story, but it's just getting started. For his mentor's tale has much further to go. Everything till now has been but the preface to Rabban Sama's epic. Just a year after installing Mar Yabalaha as the Nestorian Catholicos, Abaka died. He was replaced by the pro-Islam Ahmad, who made the life of Persia's Christians hard. He didn't last long, though. He was replaced by his brother Argun in the summer of 1284. Now, the Mongols in Persia were being threatened by a new enemy to their west, the Muslim Mamluks of Egypt, who'd managed to take control of a good part of the Middle East, including Jerusalem. Argun had no allies, and without them, Persia would fall to the Mamluks. There was only one option, Christian Europe. But an alliance with the Mongols didn't seem likely. After all, not long before all of this, the Mongols had crushed the cream of Europe's warriors in Eastern Europe. And that wasn't even the main body of the Mongol army. It was just the front screen, their reconnaissance in force. Europe was terrified of the Mongols. Nevertheless, Argun had his back to the wall. He needed to persuade the Europeans to join him in dealing with the Mamluks. And he decided that Rabban Sama was the perfect envoy to propose that alliance. Sama set out in 1287 with merchants who'd be able to translate for him. He finally arrived in Constantinople and was invited to an official audience with the Byzantine Emperor Andronicus II in the Great Palace. Now, Sama had been warned not to ask the Byzantines for an alliance with the Persian Mongols against the Mamluks. You see, the empire had lucrative trade agreements with both groups and would not jeopardize them. Sama knew better than to ask the emperor for something that he would have to decline. And so he asked instead for something the emperor would be happy to oblige, a visit to the region's religious sites and the leader of the Eastern Orthodox Church. But truth be told, that's all Sama personally was interested in. It's what had sparked his journey in the first place. His assignment as a Mongol ambassador, that was secondary. But being a man of utmost integrity, he was determined to get after it. And so after his stay in Constantinople, he resumed his journey west. He arrived in Naples in June of 1287, and after a brief stay, headed for Rome. He arrived in the Eternal City only to discover that Pope Honorius IV had died a few months before, and no new pope had been selected, mostly because many of those who were charged with selecting the new pope wanted the position for themselves. These cardinals took the unusual step of inviting Sama into the sacred place where the pope was chosen. No one else was allowed to enter their deliberations except their closest assistants. So this was an uncommon honor. Sama made a good impression and proved a welcome distraction for the grinding machinations of would-be popes and their sycophants. Their task proved so stressful that half of those cardinals died before the end of the summer. Rabban Sama pressed the cardinals to make a selection so that he could present the leader of the Western Church, the Pope, with Argun's proposal for an alliance. But they would not be hurried. They pondered what his arrival and embassy might mean for the future of Europe and the Church. How might Sama's mission affect whom they selected as the next Pope? So should they pick someone who'd be amenable to his request for an alliance, or someone who would refuse? They decided that it was best to just avoid political discussions with Iran. A safer subject, and one of genuine interest to them, was Sama's faith. How was the Church of the East now different from the Roman Church? Remember that the rift that had separated East and West occurred all the way back in the 5th century. 800 years had passed. So how had the two expressions of the Christian faith diverged, they wondered. And how had Christianity reached all the way to the Far East so that a monk would embark on such a seemingly impossible pilgrimage as Sama had? In his account, Sama admits frustration with the cardinal's refusal to let him pursue his political assignment. But when it was clear that they would not entertain his embassy, he warmed to the task of explaining his beliefs and the history of the Nestorian Church. Sama explained that the headquarters of his church was in Baghdad and that he was the patriarch of the Church of the East's official representative to the court of the famous Kublai Khan. The cardinals were eager to hear how Christianity has reached to China. Of chief concern to them was who'd brought them the gospel. The psalmist spoke of the apostle Thomas, who had carried the message of Christ to Mesopotamia and Persia and all the way to India. Thaddeus and Mari also played a role in planting churches in the East. These were all the names the cardinals were familiar with and settled any concerns that they had that the Nestorian Church rested on an apostolic foundation. Sama told them of the extensive missionary activity of the Nestorian Church. They had planted churches among the Mongols, the Turks, and the Chinese. And then he brought the conversation back around to his embassy. Christianity was favored in the Mongol realm of Persia. In fact, the Mongol ruler Argun was a good friend and supporter of the Nestorian Catholicos Maryabalaha. Like the Europeans, Argun wanted to dislodge the Muslim Mamluks from the Middle East. So, hey, how about an alliance? The cardinals retreated to safe ground. They couldn't agree to anything without a pope. Besides, the previous pope had already tried to rally support for a campaign against the Mamluks, but European leaders weren't interested. And so the cardinals once more shifted the conversation back to theological issues. They asked him for a rundown of Nestorian theology. Now, listen, this was a critical moment for Sama. He needed to keep the door open, but he was aware of some differences between Nestorian and Catholic doctrine, especially in regard to the nature of Christ. Consider for a moment how monumental the task was for Sama. He had to explain the complexities of theology, specifically the intricacies of the Trinity, in Persian, which was then translated into Latin. The cardinals listened, formulated questions for clarification, spoke them in Latin, translated back into Persian, and passed along to Sama. For goodness sakes, it's difficult enough explaining the Trinity to someone in your own tongue. Well, Sama managed to describe Nestorian beliefs in a way that the cardinals took no offense at. So, realizing that he couldn't get anything done in Rome without a pope, Sama decided to take his request for a military alliance between Christian Europe and Mongol Persia against the Muslim Mamluks directly to the kings of France and England. He picked up and headed to France. Now, Sama's hope of help from the French was keen. After all, King Louis IX, known to history as Saint Louis, played a major role in two crusades to liberate the Middle East from Muslims. His grandson, Philip IV, had only been on the throne 2 years when Sama arrived. Barely 20 years old, everyone wondered if he would reprise the career of his famous grandfather or his boring father. Sama was greeted by a large force sent by the king to escort him to Paris. They entered the city at the end of September of 1287, to much pomp and circumstance. Sama was then ushered into the palatial digs provided by King Philip. After 3 days of much-needed rest, Sama had an official audience with the French king, where he presented Argoun's proposal for an alliance against the Mamluks. Sama was encouraged by Philip's positive response, but Philip's intentions went little past his interest. The truth was, he was in no place to call another crusade, even if there had been a pope to sanction it, which, you remember, there wasn't. For Sama's part, having achieved seeming success on the official phase of his embassy, he turned to his personal adventure, which was visiting the religious sites of Paris and that area. Armed by the assumption that Sama had secured the French king's commitment to an alliance with the Mongols, he headed west to see if he could recruit the English king, Edward I. And I say west, not north, because Edward was near at hand, visiting his lands in Gascony. Not in England, but in Gascony, which was a region on the west coast of France, just north of Spain. So Sama arrived in Bordeaux in fall of 1287. Whereas the Parisians had plenty of warning of the arrival of the Far Eastern ambassador from the exotic Mongols and went all out in their greeting, the people of Bordeaux were surprised. "Who are you and why are you here?" they asked. When word was brought to King Edward, he sought to make amends for the poor way that such an august figure had been greeted. Sama smoothed over the rough start to his embassy among the English by giving Edward the gifts from Argoun. What really fired up Edward was Argoun's proposed alliance against the Mamluks. Only 6 months earlier, Edward had vowed to stage just such a crusade, and so this seemed like a mark of divine favor. Though Edward intended to immediately set out on a crusade, events back home stalled his plan. Wales rebelled again, and continental entanglements hijacked his resources and his attention. But as far as Sama was concerned, he now had support of both kings in England and France in his proposed alliance. Furthering Sama's sense of favor by the English king was the invitation to officiate communion for the royal court. Though Sama consecrated and served the elements according to the ancient Syriac formula, it was close enough to the Roman Mass that the participants were easily able to follow along, understanding not the words, but the meaning behind each movement of the ritual. And that, my friends, that's remarkable. I mean, think of this. Though it's the close of the 13th century, and these two branches of the church have been sundered from each other for 800 years, when people from the two groups engage in the focal point of their religious service, though they can't understand one another's speech, they do understand what's happening. Because the rite itself hasn't fundamentally changed. Now, that's stunning by anyone's reckoning. So, having achieved his official duties as Argoun's ambassador, Sama turned to his personal mission, which was visiting the holy sites of Edward's domains on the continent. Edward not only provided guides, he paid all of Sama's expenses. Then, late in 1287, the Raban decided it was time to head back to Rome to see if a new pope had been selected. Two of Europe's most powerful armies were now committed to the cause All they needed was permission from Rome's bishop. By the end of the year, the obstinate cardinal still had not made a selection. As much as he loved Italy, Sommer's sense of responsibility began needling him. He wasn't, as they say, getting any younger. Duty won out over ease, and Sommer began to chafe as he waited for the cardinals in Rome to get it together. Well, they finally did. In February of 1288, they elected Jerome of Ascoli as Pope Nicholas IV. It was an auspicious choice for Sommer's mission, since the new pope had spent time in the East. It helped Sommer's cause that Nicholas was one of those who had spent considerable time with in Rome. The two had hit it off, despite the language barrier. Now, Nicholas requested that Sommer celebrate Easter with his Western brethren, and he was keen to do so. Then, Easter complete and his mission finished, Sommer asked permission to return home. Pope Nicholas gave him a special letter authorizing Mar Yabalha and his Nestorian Catholicos successors as the authority over the Church of the East. He gave Rabban Sommer a letter naming him Visitor General for all churches of the East, not just of China. But implied in Nicholas's issuing of these letters was that he, as the Roman Pope, had jurisdiction over the East. Sommer might like to have contested that, but why? It's not like he was going to get Nicholas to back down. For goodness sake, the question of prime ecclesiastical authority had been going on for hundreds of years. Sommer was under no illusion that he was going to set things right now. Rather, all he could do was blow up the alliance that seemed to be a done deal. So after giving Sommer a gift of gold to help pay his expenses, Sommer began preparations to return home. As the time for Sommer's departure drew near, Pope Nicholas made it clear that while the kings of France and England seemed gung-ho for an alliance, only he, as the Pope, could call a crusade. Knowing the mindset of the rest of Europe, a crusade wasn't in the cards. He adroitly sidestepped making a commitment while at the same time encouraging the Mongols to do their best against the common enemy, the Mamluks. Nicholas wasn't done with his letter writing, though. He penned one to Mar Yabalha as well. It began by praising the Nestorian Catholicos for his wise leadership. But it went then into a long lecture on proper Christian doctrine. The last paragraph was a tactless statement of the supremacy of the Roman Church and Pope. Disappointed, Sommer tamped down any expression of it in his last meeting with the Pope. He was just glad to be quitting the West and the prospect of getting home. His route was the same as the one that he took West. Sommer arrived back in Persia 5 months later. He handed off the various gifts and letters and gave his report. Argon was so pleased at Sama's mission, he promised to build the Rabban his own chapel and home to retire to in the capital. Sommer asked instead that it be built near the home of his friend Mar Yabalha. Now in his late 60s, Sommer settled into the life that he'd lived years before as a young man, one of quiet study and personal ministry to everyday followers of Christ. He reports that this was the happiest and most fulfilling time of his long and eventful life. Sommer's body, racked by intense pain, finally gave out in January of 1294. Mar Yabalha was inconsolable. He wept profusely for 3 straight days, and that was followed by a melancholy that took months to dissipate. Then the Nestorian Catholicos engaged in a series of correspondences with the Roman popes, following up on the lines of communication that had been forged by Sommer. As we end this episode, while Rabban Sommer never returned to China and the court of Kublai Khan to complete his adventure, he did accomplish most of what he had set out to do. His original ambition, encouraged by his friendship with the young Marcos, was a religious pilgrimage to the headquarters of the Nestorian Church in Baghdad and the centers of Western Christianity. His dream of visiting Jerusalem, birthplace of the faith, went unrealized because of the Mamluk domination of Palestine. Sommer was a genuine scholar who did more than read books. He went to the places they spoke about. He was a gifted linguist, a skilled theologian, an effective diplomat. He must have been an eminently likable fellow who got along with everyone. All who met him embraced him quickly and sought to include him as an ally. His immense wisdom was repeatedly demonstrated in his skill at avoiding subjects sure to arouse the ire of his hosts.